TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
A Question of Survival. Noam Chomsky's lecture on the current nuclear danger at the University College Dublin, Ireland, in January 2006. Professor Noam Chomsky repeated the urgent appeal to end all war that was first issued by Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein. The terrible contradiction of our time is that the U.S. is threatening war, including nuclear strikes, against countries such as North Korea and Iran for their alleged or real ownership of nuclear weapons, while actively dispersing these weapons and nuclear material for reactors to countries of their liking, such as Israel. In this speech, Chomsky said if the U.S. was serious about stopping the spread of nuclear weapons, it should stop compelling other countries to have them. Here is the introduction of Professor Chomsky to an overflow audience at the University College in Dublin.
I'm very much struck by the extraordinary turnout for Dr. Chomsky. I haven't seen anything like it, and I don't mean to disparage either of them by this, since the Pope's visit. And I don't expect Dr. Chomsky to say, young people of Ireland, I love you, but it's clear that the young people of Ireland love him. And would you welcome, please, Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Half a century ago, in July 1955, Bertrand Russell and Einstein issued an extraordinary appeal to the people of the world, asking them, quote, to set aside the strong feelings they have about many issues and consider yourselves only as members of a biological species which has had a remarkable history and whose disappearance none of us can desire. We face a choice, they said, that is stark and dreadful and inescapable. Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war? Well, war has not been renounced, of course. Quite the contrary. The world's hegemonic power accords itself the right to wage war at will under a doctrine called anticipatory self-defense with unstated bounds. And it's backed in that stance by the spear carrier for Pax Americana, as Blair's Britain is described by a former NATO planner, Michael Maguire, in the Journal of Britain's Royal Institute of International Affairs. The Russell-Einstein warning is no less stark after half a century of denial. There have been efforts to strengthen the thin thread on which survival hangs. Now, the most important is the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, which came into force in 1970, in good part on Irish initiative. I recently learned 10 minutes ago. On the 50th anniversary of the appeal, the regular five-year review conference of the NPT took place. That's last May in New York. A leading concern of participants and close observers was Washington's intent, I'm quoting, intent to remove the nuclear brakes, taking a big and dangerous step that will lead to the transformation of the nuclear bomb into a legitimate weapon for waging war. That's quoting one of Israel's leading military analysts, Reuven Pedatzur. That was a significant factor, in fact, the main factor, in the dismal failure of the review conference, which may, in fact, mean its end. I'll come back to these ominous developments, which were barely reported in the United States and little appreciated among the general public. That thin thread on which survival hangs, has almost snapped since the Russell-Einstein appeal, repeatedly, in fact. The best-known case is the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. The escape from nuclear oblivion seems miraculous. Two of the most prominent researchers recently concluded in a book about it. There was a retrospective conference in Havana in the year 2002, October 2002, and at that conference, the historian, well-known historian and Kennedy advisor, Arthur Schlesinger, described the missile crisis as the most dangerous moment in human history. And participants in the conference learned to their amazement that the dangers were even more severe than they had believed. They discovered at the conference that the world was literally one word away from the first use of a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki. The one word was that of a Russian submarine commander, Vasily Arkhipov, who should receive many Nobel Peace Prizes. He countermanded an order to fire nuclear-armed torpedoes when the Russian submarines were under attack by U.S. destroyers, and the commanders believed that a nuclear war was underway. Had he fired that nuclear-armed weapon, the consequences could have been dreadful, in fact, terminal. These revelations received very scant reporting and very little interest. That would have been remarkable at any time, but it was particularly so at that moment. That moment was described as the most dangerous time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. It's Michael Crepin, who was the founder of the Strategic Studies Center in Washington, the Stimson Institute. The U.S. and Britain had at that time, as you know, just virtually announced their plans to invade Iraq, knowing full well that the attack would probably escalate terror and nuclear proliferation, as in fact it did. And it was also no secret at that time that a major contributory factor to the 1962 brush with disaster was a topic that was of great concern, prime concern, right at the moment of the 2002 conference, namely international terrorism. In 1962, the Kennedy campaign to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba was a factor in the major factor in the crisis. The phrase terrors of the earth is that of Arthur Schlesinger again, in his biography of Robert Kennedy, and according to Schlesinger, to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba was Robert Kennedy's highest concern. He was in charge of the terrorist war, which was put on hold briefly during the missile crisis and resumed immediately after the crisis subsided. One of the high-level planners who attended the Havana retrospective was Kennedy's Defense Secretary, Robert McNamara, and he recalled that the world, in his words, came within a hair's breadth of nuclear disaster during the missile crisis. And he accompanied this reminder with a warning, namely a warning of what he called apocalypse soon. He described current U.S. nuclear weapons policy as immoral, illegal, militarily unnecessary, and dreadfully dangerous, creating unacceptable risks to other nations and to our own, both the risk of accidental or inadvertent nuclear launch, which is unacceptably high, and of nuclear attack by terrorists. He endorsed the judgment of Clinton's Secretary of Defense, William Perry, that his words again, there's a greater than 50% probability of a nuclear strike on U.S. targets within a decade. And those threats are being escalated, in fact, consciously escalated, by the U.S. and Britain. The Iraq invasion is only the most glaring example. There's a consensus in the U.S. government's intelligence command that a dirty bomb attack, nuclear bomb attack, a dirty nuclear bomb attack is inevitable, in their words, and an attack with a devastating nuclear weapon is highly likely if fissionable materials, which are the essential ingredient, are not retrieved and secured, and their further production controlled. I'll come back to the critical question of controlling production very much on the front pages today, but in the wrong context. There, which I'll get to, there had been some success in retrieving and securing fissionable materials since the early 1990s. That was under the initiatives of two U.S. senators, Sam Nunn and Richard Lugar. But these programs were put on the shelf by the new Bush administration. They were not interested in the programs to avert what the intelligence community called inevitable nuclear terror, just as they sidelined the so-called war on terror so that they could devote their energies to driving the country to war and then to efforts to contain somehow the catastrophe that they had created in Iraq. In the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is as respectable as you can get and not given to hyperbole, two prominent strategic analysts warned recently that the Bush administration military programs and its aggressive stance carry, in their words, an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And they explain the reasons, which are straightforward. Pursuit of total security by one state, including the right to wage war at will and to release the nuclear brakes, that entails the insecurity of others who are likely to react. And they will make use of the terrifying technology that's now being developed in what Donald Rumsfeld calls the transformation of the military. And they point out that that technology will assuredly diffuse to the rest of the world. And in the context of competition and intimidation, there's an action-reaction cycle which creates, quote them, rising danger, potentially an unmanageable one. Hence, transformation, as currently being practiced, carries an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. Ultimate doom means terminal. Human species is over. Authors express the hope that the threat that the U.S. government is posing to its own population and to the world will be countered by a coalition of peace-loving states led by China. We've come to a pretty pass when thoughts like that are expressed right at the heart of the establishment. They bring up China for a good reason. It's because of all the nuclear states, it has maintained by far the most restrained pattern of military deployment. These are quotes all the way through. China has led the efforts at the United Nations to block the unilateral U.S. refusal to preserve space for peaceful purposes. That's since the Clinton years. The Clinton administration refused to join the call of the entire world, apart from Israel, in renewal and extension of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which does reserve space for peaceful purposes. And they immobilized the UN Disarmament Commission by barring outright any moves towards prevention of an arms race in outer space. Clinton's Space Command explained the reasons. They called for, quoting the Space Command, dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment, much in the way that armies and navies had done so in earlier years, but now with a sole hegemon, no competition, the United States, which must develop space-based strike weapons, enabling the application of precision force from, to, and through space. U.S. intelligence and the Space Command during the Clinton years agreed, and their analysis is worth paying close attention to, they agreed that such measures will be necessary because globalization of the world economy will lead to a widening economic divide along with deepening economic stagnation, political instability, and cultural alienation, hence unrest and violence among the have-nots, much of it directed against the United States. So therefore, the United States must be ready for precision strike from space as a counter to the worldwide proliferation of weapons of mass destruction by unruly elements. That's a likely consequence of the recommended military programs, just as the widening divide and increasing unrest is the anticipated consequence of the specific version of international integration that's misleadingly called globalization or free trade and the doctrinal system. Well, the danger to everyone else is becoming even more serious as the Bush administration extended Clinton's doctrine. Clinton's doctrine was control of space for military purposes. The Bush administration extended it, I'm quoting, to ownership of space, which means instant engagement anywhere in the world. That puts the entire world at risk of instant destruction, thanks to sophisticated global surveillance and offensive weaponry in space. Bush's extension of the Clinton space doctrine was one implementation of the national security strategy announced in September 2002. The Space Command quotes are from shortly after. The national security strategy declared what was called a new imperial grand strategy. That's what it was called in a critical article immediately in the leading establishment journal, Foreign Affairs. Well, as would be expected, Russia reacted to Pentagon reports about militarization of space by announcing that it would consider using force if necessary to respond. Similarly, as had been anticipated, Russia had reacted to Bush's vast increase in offensive military capacity by sharply increasing its own capacities aimed at the United States. That's the action-reaction cycle, which everyone knows about. China was expected to follow what's called missile defense, which on all sides is understood to be a first strike weapon. That's a particularly severe danger to China. If the programs, there's a lot of talk about the programs not working, but that's missing the point. As long as they don't work, they're not a problem. If they show any sign of success, then we're in trouble, because China is likely to expand its offensive capacities to preserve its deterrent. In fact, that's a near certainty, which means more offensive missiles with multiple warheads aimed at the United States. It's the immediate consequence of any success in missile defense. In 2004, the United States accounted for 95% of total global military space expenditures, but others may join if they're compelled to do so. Both U.S. and Chinese analysts interpret all this in very similar terms. So U.S. analysts describe the programs currently under development by Washington as a significant move by the United States towards weaponization of space, and point out that space-facing of weapons is very likely to have a negative effect on the national security of the United States. That's from the Naval War College Review. A Chinese analyst, now visiting Harvard as a visiting fellow, he writes that to China and to many other countries, the construction of these systems looks like the development of the Death Star spaceship in the Star Wars film series. which can be used to attack military and civilian satellites and targets anywhere, anywhere on Earth. The deployment of space weapons, which everyone understands to be first strike weapons, is likely to lead China and others to develop low-cost space weapons in reaction. So the U.S. policy, still quoting him, could trigger an arms race in space. Furthermore, he writes that to protect against the potential loss of its deterrent capability, China could also resort to building up its nuclear forces, which would set off a ripple effect. It would encourage, in fact, almost compel India to do the same. That would have an effect on Pakistan, then spreads without limit. Russia had already announced that it would do so, as I said. Others understand as well the same conclusions. So senior military and space officials of the European Union, Canada, China, and Russia recently published a statement objecting to these Bush administration plans, writing that the psychological impact of a blow from space might rival that of devastating attacks, such devastating attacks as Hiroshima. And just as the unleashing of nuclear weapons had unforeseen consequences, so too would the weaponization of space. Michael McGuire, former NATO planner, continues the article I was talking about with some very important information that's not well known. This is from the years when he was a NATO planner. Same writing in the British Journal of International Affairs, the Royal Institute Journal. He reminds us that in 1986, recognizing what he calls the dreadful logic of nuclear weapons, Mikhail Gorbachev called for their total elimination. But that proposal foundered on Reagan's militarization of space programs and called Star Wars informally. At the time, NATO doctrine was explicitly premised on the credible threat of first use of nuclear weapons, and that continues to be policy today. Russia kept to the same doctrine until 1994, when it reversed its stand and adopted a no first use policy and called for elimination of nuclear weapons. However, Russia reverted to the NATO doctrine and abandoned its call for abolition of nuclear weapons in response to a very important act of Clinton's, which is little known, namely the expansion of NATO to the east. That was violating a firm commitment by Washington, a categorical assurance, in fact, to Gorbachev, that if Gorbachev would agree to a rearmed Germany, reunited Germany, remaining totally in NATO, then the NATO alliance would not expand eastwards to absorb former members of the Warsaw Pact. That was the categorical assurance. Clinton's violation of these firm pledges posed a very serious security threat to Russia. Clinton's violation of the pledge explains why NATO also rejected Russian proposals for a nuclear weapons-free zone encompassing Central Europe from the Arctic to the Baltic Sea. That would have interfered with Clinton's plans to expand NATO to the east in violation of the firm commitment not to do so. All of that, obviously, enhanced the likelihood of apocalypse soon. But that has never been a high priority for planners, neither Clinton or Bush. Senator Nunn, who I mentioned before, a conservative senator, highly respected figure who's played a leading role in efforts to reduce the threat of nuclear war. He wrote recently in the British Financial Times that the chances for an accidental, mistaken, or unauthorized nuclear attack might be increasing as a result of policy choices that leave America's survival dependent on accuracy of Russia's warning systems and its command and control, we are running an unnecessary risk of an Armageddon of our own making, he wrote. What Nunn is referring to is the very sharp expansion of U.S. military programs, which tilt the strategic balance sharply in ways that essentially make Russia, quoting him, make Russia more likely to launch upon warning of an attack without waiting to see if the warning is accurate, because they'll have no choice. And that threat is enhanced by the fact that the Russian early warning system is in serious disrepair, along with the collapse of the Russian economy in the 1990s, and therefore more likely to give a false warning of incoming missiles. U.S. reliance on high-alert, hair-trigger nuclear posture allows missiles to be launched within minutes, actually 3 minutes, forcing our leaders to decide almost instantly whether to launch nuclear weapons once they have a warning of attack, robbing them of the time they might need to gather data, exchange information, and generally assess the situation, gain some perspective, discover errors. We know that that's happened hundreds of times for the U.S. systems, and the anticipated Russian reaction to the Bush administration aggressive militarism increases the risk of an Armageddon of our own making, well beyond even that intolerable level.
This was the first half of a one-hour talk by Professor Noam Chomsky on the question of survival. He spoke at the University College Dublin, Ireland in January 2006. Professor Chomsky teaches linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and is the author of many books on U.S. foreign policy and the media. Come back for the second part of his talk when TUC Radio returns. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this important talk. You can find more information on Noam Chomsky on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.